Here is the last part of my four-part interview with Professor Gary Francione on activism. You can find the full interview at abolitionistapproach.com. You know, I'm going to get in a little bit about the this kind of defeatist attitude that vegan education is either too radical, too extreme, that the opportunity's not there, or even that we need to hire somebody else to do it. And I'll explain what that means. First of all, to backtrack a little bit, you mentioned Elizabeth Collins. I wanted to let my listeners know that Elizabeth runs the New Zealand Vegan Podcast, which is at nzveganpodcast.blogspot.com, or NZ, as they say. You know, she's, like Gary said, she's a very creative, smart woman. She's got a lot of, you know, great ideas, and I highly recommend that. And Gary also mentioned a video that he has on his website, abolitionistapproach.com. And I want to repeat what he said, which is that that video doesn't have a lot of blood and guts. And
it has none.
It has none. And I repeat that because I've told some of my peers, like, you know, you got to see these videos. You just got to see it for yourselves. And I think they honestly have a desire to see them. And so it's unfortunate to me when they say it's just like, oh, I just don't know if I can handle it, because I want to sympathize with them on that, because I can't. I can barely handle it. I watch them because I want to know, you know, but I sympathize with that idea. And so it's good that there is something that is, as far as just the blood and guts part, it's a little easier to take in, but you can still get something out of it. And I have watched this video, and Gary's right. I don't know. I don't know how you can see these animals and say, yeah, you know, an ice cream cone's worth it, or, you know, like a hamburger, whatever it might be. And, you know, Gary, you said some nice words about me and my kiosk. This was
I did a blog post about it. People should see what you're doing. It's easy. I mean, it's like you show people how to do it. I mean, you do everything except go to their houses and build it for them. And you know, that's what I'm talking about when I talk about creative, nonviolent vegan education. You and Elizabeth are two examples that come to mind. There are other people who are doing other things.
Yeah.
There are people who are doing pamphlets and stuff like that. But, you know, there are people who are doing the pamphlets that you're distributing on your kiosk. There are, you know, there's all sorts of things that people are doing all over the place. And go, you know, go to the website and you can read the essay on Adam. And I think it links to your YouTube
Yes, there's a YouTube video that shows kind of like me building it. And, you know, a lot of those ideas actually came from Eric Prescott, who, you know, he's Boston Vegan Association. And he built a kiosk himself, which is actually, you know, it's quite remarkable. And he actually designed the – I don't know if it was him or like a group in the Boston Vegan, but he's – you know, the Boston Vegan Association is responsible for this packet, or rather a pamphlet that I was handing out there along with the the trifold pamphlet that you have at your site, which is just a like a basic ideological rundown of animal rights, and it talks to people in very simple terms. And you know, I want to say a few things about activism, because I think some of the young kids, when they're getting into veganism and animal rights, they're taught to believe that in order to be active, you have to pay someone to do it for you, or you have to sign a waiver for someone else to do it for you. And the two examples I see, which are the most common labels of activism, are signing a petition and giving a donation. And I'm not going to say that, you know, all petitions and all donations are bad. I mean, personally, I have signed a few petitions, and I donate money to some animal sanctuaries. But if you have any sort of means of communication, you can use that. If you have a pen, if you have a printer, Twitter, whatever, it's just a mouth, you know, talking right in your household or in your school, you know, converting your cafeteria. There's always a means. I don't care where you live or who you are. I think everybody is capable of that. Finally, I'd like to put out a few things, some of the things that Gary has, and I've mentioned some of them, including the videos and the pamphlets. First of all, his blog post, I know they're translated into English and French. Did you also have German, or was that?
Yeah, there's German, Spanish, Portuguese. The blog posts are blog posts are in multiple languages. The abolitionist pamphlet is in 11 languages. Mm-hmm. The movies, The Theory of Animal Rights, Rights versus Welfare, Animals as Property, and Animal Law are all in multiple languages. You know, we're about to add Theory of Animal Rights in Japanese, which is a bit more difficult to do, but we're doing that. And you know, we're getting the word out. It's getting out, and those materials are available. You know, I also have the books too. I mean, for those of you who like a longer treatment of things, and find Twitter-like communications to be as frustrating as I do, you might want to actually pick up one of the books, which you can get in libraries or, you know, in bookstores or whatever. And the new one, I'm really excited about the new one because that one. You know, that Robert Garner is a very smart guy. He's at the University of Leicester. He's the chair of the political science department at Leicester in the United Kingdom. And Robert has Robert and I have been engaged in a sort of a very nonviolent, peaceful mano a mano controversy debate about animal rights versus animal welfare. And Robert is. You know, Robert is one of the few people who actually thinks, well, he may be one of the only people who actually thinks about this stuff theoretically. And he tries to sort of think about why, you know, if animal welfare is a good thing to do, why it's a good thing to do. And so Robert I have a lot of respect for him. And I disagree with him, but I have a lot of respect for him. And so we decided, you know, rather than continuing to write articles in which we criticize each other, that why didn't we debate? So the book has got three parts. The first part is I argue abolition. The second part is Robert argues regulation. And the third part is we debate. You know, we go back and forth about things. And what's interesting, and I think would be very great for your readers and listeners if they're interested in this sort of thing, is it really does make clear, because Robert is probably, you know, he's a very progressive welfarist. He's in the mold of the sort of the, you know, he's in the mold of the in many ways the PETA person or the Singer person or the HSUS person. So he's not like the welfarist of, you know, 1920 or 1870, but he's although there were some very good welfarists back then and there were some interesting things that were going on, but he's a progressive welfarist, and he himself is a vegan, at least as far as what he eats. I don't know that he's a vegan in terms of clothing. I'm not sure, but he's a vegan. He's not really opposed to rights. He just doesn't think that animals have a right not to be used. He thinks they have a right not to suffer. And what we debate in the book is, how can you have a right not to suffer, because all use involves suffering? And that's sort of the thing that we go back and forth on. But I think Robert's views quite accurately reflect, whether or not people are aware of they're agreeing with Robert or not. They may not even know who Robert Garner is, but I think that that Professor Garner's approach is very much reflective of how most people think about things. That is, many of the people who are welfarists or new welfarists or protectionists or whatever you want to call them think that animals have a right not to suffer, but they don't have a right not to be used. And Robert is quite explicit in saying that he thinks that, you know, that he agrees with the view that Singer articulates, that animals have less of a moral value than do humans. And I think that really, Adam, that's what it all boils down to. If you agree with that, then welfarism makes sense to you. I still think welfare regulation, because of the economic status of animals, is going to be a dismal failure. But nevertheless, you know, I can understand if somebody says to me, I don't think animals have an interest in their lives, and I don't think it matters that we use them. I think it's just a question of how we kill them and how we treat them. I can understand then the focus on treatment and the effort to try to get better standards of treatment. Although, as I repeat, for the 80 millionth time, because they're chattel property, the standards of treatment are always going to be very low. But if you reject that view, that animals have lesser of a moral value than do humans, as I do, if you take the view that all of that is elitist nonsense and you know, the hierarchical fantasies of the Enlightenment, which have sort of just permeated into our brains and we now think that they're true, then I would suggest that you know, you've got to come out in a different way on this. And, you know, and then you really got to think about some of these analogies about, you know, whether or not it's better to be shocked in a padded chair rather than in a hard chair, because that's really what the regulation standards come down to, or whether or not, you know, if rape is wrong, should we, in light of the fact that rape is a ubiquitous phenomenon, unfortunately, in the world in which we live, should we campaign for humane rape, or should we, you know, seek to abolish rape? And if we want to seek to abolish rape, if we want to say rape is wrong and we're not going to be promoting, you know, humane rape, then we need to ask ourselves, well, why is it that we think it's all right to do so for animals, to do that with animals? And the answer has got to be because we think that there's a species difference. And then I think we get into all sorts of value judgments, which are very, very hard to square.
Okay, now that book is coming out pretty soon, is that correct?
Well, it's gone to the publisher. It's probably going to the publisher this afternoon. Mm-hmm. And it should be out. I don't know. You know, it just depends on how long the copy editing takes. It should be out in the fall sometime.
Mm-hmm. And Gary also has a number of books behind him as well. He has. I'm currently reading one of his first, which is simply just a practical guide to conscientious. I got that Omaha accent, you know. Conscientious objection to dissection in the classroom.
Actually, the first book I wrote was the one I did with Anna Charlton, which is the conscientious objection thing, which is basically what to do if you're a student and, you know, somebody tells you you got to cut up a frog or a dog to get through a class, and that's more sort of a practical legal guide.
Right.
And then Animals, Property, and the Law, which I wrote in 1995. Mm-hmm. Which basically laid out the theory of because animals are property, the standard of welfare regulation was invariably going to be very low. Then I wrote Rain Without Thunder in 1996, in which I argued that the animal rights movement and the animal welfare movement the animal rights movement had collapsed or was in danger of collapsing. I didn't realize how bad it was going to get, but that it was in danger of collapsing into a welfare movement and that there were serious differences between rights and welfare. Then in 2000, I did Introduction to Animal Rights or Child or the Dog. And then 2008, I did Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation. And this year I'm doing the Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Regulation with Robert Garner. And so, so I've got those books, and those books will explain. I mean, I think if you were going to look at one, I mean, Animals, Property, and the Law is sort of a more technical book. There's a lot of law in there. I'm very proud of the book, and I think it makes, you know, very good arguments. But I also think, you know, it's a book which, if you don't have a real sort of deep interest in law and legal theory, it may not be your cup of tea. Rain Without Thunder is an interesting, I think, book, a sociological statement about where the movement was in 1995. In many ways, when I wrote that book, I never would have predicted it would have gotten as bad as it's gotten now. Mm-hmm. I never would have predicted, for example, that PETA would have engaged in the, you know, would be involved in the campaigns, the welfarist campaigns that it's in now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I saw those things emerging then, but they weren't nearly as bad. Introduction to Animal Rights is, I think, a really good introduction. It sort of brings the reader into this whole idea about, you know, what do we mean when we say necessary suffering? You know, this is an idea that we all sort of take seriously, but yet when we try to see, you know, we try to cash it out and see what its real value is, we see that, you know, we engage in all sorts of behavior and all sorts of harm and suffering and death, which cannot be regarded as necessary in any sense. But you know, so I think the two most recent books, Animals as Persons, that has an interesting chapter. The first chapter presents my theory of animal rights in a more abbreviated form. So in a sense, I guess if you don't want to read all of Introduction to Animal Rights, you can read the first chapter of Animals as Persons. The second chapter deals with why animal welfare has failed over the past, and how animal welfare has failed over the past 10 years. Then there are some other essays in there about why sentience is the only thing that matters, that, you know, like, for example, you know, 1992, Peter Singer invited me to write a chapter for the Great Ape Project, which I did. Now, I made my point then that I didn't think that you needed anything more than sentience, but in retrospect, the whole Great Ape Project was a really bad idea because it was suggesting that some animals are more equal than others. And they, you know, some animals are different from others and they may have different interests, but for purposes of whether, you know, I don't think that a non-human great ape has any greater moral value than a mouse for purposes of whether you're going to exploit one as a piece of property. And so, you know, so my view is that we ought not to be, as a matter of fact, I gave an interview last week, some legislation pending in the Congress now about, you know, giving great apes greater protection. And my, you know, I said to the reporter, look, obviously I don't think we should be exploiting great apes. What I'm not happy with is the idea that the reason why great apes deserve moral protection is because they're like us. And I, you know, I find that like offensive in the same way I find it offensive if some say, well, we're going to exclude black people from the moral community, but if they have some white blood, we'll let them in. You know, I mean, that's the sort of thing I find offensive and, you know, morally offensive. And so, you know, but there's some essays in there about sentience. And then I have the essay about Tom Reagan and the dog in the lifeboat and why I think that that presents a problem for Tom's theory. And I have an essay in there about ecofeminism, because I think that some of the ecofeminists, some of the feminist scholars who say that we don't need rights who say that rights are patriarchal, I think are simply mistaken, and I don't think they understand what a right means. I mean, a right is simply a way of protecting an interest.
Right.
To say that a right is inherently patriarchal is like saying a hammer is inherently patriarchal. A hammer can be used for all sorts of purposes, including, you know, to assault women, so it can be used in a sexist way, but that doesn't mean that there's anything inherently patriarchal about a hammer. A right is simply a way of protecting an interest. It says that if I have an interest in free speech, to say I have a right of free speech is to say that my interest in my free speech is going to be protected, even if other people will be happier if I am silenced. And so it basically says that, you know, it doesn't mean is your right, your interest is absolutely protected. It means your right is protected against being taken away from you for purely consequential reasons. And I don't see how that can be inherently patriarchal. And I point out that, every woman I know believes that women have an interest in bodily integrity that means that they should not be raped under any circumstances, whether there's an ethic of care that's been observed or not. And so, you know, feminists recognize that there are rights when it comes to certain women's issues. And I just think that it becomes speciesist to say that, well, you know, when you talk about rights for animals, then, you know, all of a sudden it becomes patriarchal and terrible and, you know, you shouldn't do it. So I have an essay in there about that. The upcoming book is just basically focusing on this debate. It will be of interest to people who are interested in the subjects we've been talking about today. You know, it is a book for those people who want to think through this issue and want to think through it having, you know, I don't know how long it'll be in print, but, you know, two 60, 70 page essays each presenting. I think I present my case in a strong way. I think Robert presents his case in a strong way. And then we have a debate and let the reader make a decision, you know, about who's got the better side of the debate. And I think it's a really good book in that it shows that people can discuss these issues civilly. We don't have to engage in name-calling. And Robert and I disagree very, very strongly. I mean, we have very, very strong disagreements. But, you know, that doesn't mean I don't think Robert's a great guy. It doesn't mean that I think he's very sincere. I just think he's wrong. You know?
You know, and as a personal testimonial, the first book by Francium that I read was Rain Without Thunder. And, you know, even though it is, you said it was it 1996 that was published?
Yeah.
I mean, it laid it all out to me. And, you know, going into that as a, by default, kind of like a welfarist-minded person, I read this point after point after point. I'm just thinking, how did I not realize this? How could I have been so blind? And I think there are some good answers to that question. But, you know, I that's the one, you know, that I would recommend. I can't say that I've read every single one of your books, but.
Well, Adam, you should be ashamed. I'm sorry, but you should be ashamed of yourself. I mean, there's only so much that living in Nebraska can let you get away with, you know. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, for a place that just got indoor plumbing and, you know. books
exactly,
are kind
exactly.
of.
I mean, you know, exactly, books, and it's hard to read at candlelight and stuff. I understand. but no, I mean, I hope that all of your listeners and readers in Nebraska and any place else that's not the East Coast or the West Coast know that I am just sort of playing on the snobbery that unfortunately does characterize a lot of people.
Well, you know, Gary, you're a likable guy. I don't think it needs explanation, but it's been a pleasure having you, in this interview, and I'll be happy to just get this out in as many mediums as possible, with links to some of your resources, some of the things mentioned in the show, including Gary's Twitter account, which he now has.
I actually have a Facebook account, but
a Facebook account.
You know what? Do you want to know? You know what? How sad this is. I actually had to call somebody last night to say exactly what is this Facebook thing? What is the idea behind it? What is it that I'm supposed to be trying to achieve? And the person I was talking to was saying, well, you really don't understand. And I said, no, I really just don't understand. You know, I'm not sure I understand Twitter. I mean, I understand it's like I'm supposed to sort of say something very quickly and stuff. And somebody's telling me that I have to retweet, which I don't understand what the hell that means. But it's really sort of sad, and it really makes me very sad. But I'm gonna now that my book is done, I'm gonna get somebody to explain what this Facebook business is, and because I understand that, you know, this is how we all communicate these days in these social wealth, these virtual community. What do you call them?
Social communities and social platforms. I mean, they're made for people with very short attention spans. And if you don't have a short attention span, it will train you to have one. And I know that I've.
And that's really, in many ways, that's the great danger, is that the computers and this, all of this stuff is, if you don't have a short attention span, as you quite brilliantly put it, if you don't have one, you'll certainly get one pretty shortly, because that's a problem, because many of the difficulties that we face as a species, whether it's animal ethics, whether it's the ecological crisis, whether it's violence, whether it's malnutrition and problems of the poor, whether it's women's problems, the problems of the mentally challenged. I mean, there are all sorts of issues out there that require some pretty complicated thinking, and we need to, I think, be able to have an attention span that's longer than three and a half minutes. But in any event, I am capitulating to this. I am being dragged into the 21st century doing this stuff, mm-hmm. because my view is, if I can get any number of you to think about this, I'll do it. Even if I find it that it gives me a headache to look at all these various boxes and pictures and who's my friend and who wants to befriend me and who's inviting me to befriend somebody else, and it's like my God, you know, what the hell's going on here? But anyway, so thank you very much. I have enjoyed and I want to tell you, I really the bottom line is, it's people like you and Elizabeth and many other people. I don't mean to just say, you know, Jeff Purrs in Australia, and there's people all over the place. There's a zillion of you now, and I mean, I'm getting flooded with emails from people, you know, that they're building kiosks and they're distributing pamphlets and they're going to community colleges and whatnot. But really, it's your game now. You know, I intend to keep doing this until for as long as I can. But I'm a vegan. I got a lot of energy, and I hope to keep doing it for a long time. But the bottom line is that the way this is going to be presented and the way the form that the education is going to take is largely going to be determined by people like you and Elizabeth and your colleagues. And so you got to give it a lot of thought, because, my friend, a great responsibility rests on your shoulders. I mean, I don't want to make you feel nervous or anything, but a great responsibility rests on your shoulders, because
absolutely,
I think education now is going to take on some very, very interesting dimensions.
And that's a great thought to leave with. Thanks so much again, Gary Francia.
Okay. Thank you so much, Adam. I've enjoyed it very much. Thanks a lot.
And that website again is www.abolitionistapproach.com.